Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, May 22nd, 2023. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Food banks struggle to fill need for assistance. Government aid and donations wane as inflation drives up demand. This is by Emily Anderson. Elnora Jordan spends about $100 on groceries every month. It's enough, but only because she is one of thousands of people in Lynn, Johnson, and Washington counties who are fed each day by Horizons Meals on Wheels volunteers. You get a raise, but then your rent goes up. Sometimes I don't have money to buy groceries, Jordan said. My mom and father, before they died, they told me we were going to be in the soup line, and I'm getting very close to it. Horizons Meals on Wheels program delivers for free up to one hot meal per day to thousands of community members who are elderly or disabled and mostly unable to leave their homes unassisted. Many, like Jordan, rely on these meals not only because it's difficult to do their own shopping, but also because their finances have gotten tighter as inflation worsened. It ensures that you get that one meal a day. That's what I like about it, Amity Blakely, who has been on the Meals on Wheels program for several years, said. I know I've got that full meal at lunchtime. Kaggy Baker has been receiving meals from the program for 15 years. She said she's grateful for the help she's able to get because that one meal makes a big difference. It helps a lot because I can't get out. I don't have transportation. It's a wonderful program because you have your meals brought to you warm like that, Baker said. It's magnificent. In the last few years, the number of people who rely on Meals on Wheels services has increased dramatically. Mike Barnhart, the chief executive officer of Horizons in Cedar Rapids, said that the nonprofit has added about 50 people to its roster of meal recipients each month for the past several months. Horizons also offers other meal services, such as providing breakfasts for elderly residents who can come to the Horizons building in the morning, like Annie Little. She said she comes mostly to socialize, but it's also helpful to lessen what she has to pay for groceries each month. If you need help, they'll give it, Little said of Horizons programs. Potential food scarcity crisis. Horizons, like other Iowa food-based nonprofits, has been facing a deficit between the amount of food available and the number of people who need its services. By the end of fiscal 2023, at the end of June, the nonprofit expects to have a funding shortage of almost $137,000, or 16,203 more meals delivered than what Horizons can actually afford. Some recipients have been receiving two meals per day, but starting last January, all new meal recipients have only been able to receive one. We just always manage, and that's the nature of nonprofit work. We're not in this business to tell people no when they ask us for food, Barnhart said. At some point, we may have to start a wait list. We may have to prioritize people based off their nutritional score. Those are some of the things we've talked about. At some point, we're going to hit a capacity limit, and those are the types of things we're going to have to look at. We're going to have to serve those that are absolutely the most in need. Horizons gets federal funding from the Older Americans Act, but that money covers only about half of what it costs to make each meal. The rest comes from grants, fundraising, and donations. At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, there were a lot of government grants available and funding from the American Rescue Plan Act. But that money is starting to run out, and the need for food has continued increasing. According to Melissa Wall, the Horizons director in community health and nutrition, other local food-based nonprofits are seeing similar issues. As inflation continues and pandemic-based funding diminishes, their food supplies can't keep up with the amount of people who need assistance. Community Food Bank in Iowa City has served about 5,300 households so far this year. At this time last year, the food bank had served about 3,500 households, according to Crystal Cabella, the food bank manager for Community. Some of those families return to the food bank weekly or monthly, but others may have come only once or twice. Community has been serving about 1,100 households each week, and about 75 to 100 households are being added to its list of clients each month. The word that we try to spread, the message that we try to send, is everyone's welcome. There are no restrictions. It doesn't matter what your socioeconomic class is. It doesn't matter what your income is. If you're in need, we want to help, Cabella said. A few of the items in the food bank, like milk and eggs, have limits regarding how much some One can take, and each household is allowed only one weekly visit. Cabela said she'd love to work toward removing those restrictions, but that doesn't seem feasible without additional donations and funding. Those who aren't here don't see what we see every day. So I can tell you our shelves are empty. But until people have a visual of that, they don't understand what empty shelves mean to us, Cabela said. According to Kim Guardado, the food reservoir director for the Hawkeye Area Community Action Program, availability for food banks increased before COVID-19 struck because trade disputes in 2019 meant less food was being exported out of the country and more food was available nationally to food banks. That dropped off in 2022 just as inflation started causing more people to seek help. At the same time, donations decreased because many donors struggled to cope with inflation themselves. It's kind of like this perfect storm of all these things together that's really causing this huge decrease in the amount of food that's out there, as well as an increase in the needs. So it's very disproportionate right now, Guardado said. Food banks are anticipating that this disparity will continue to grow, especially after recently passed state legislation that will limit food assistance programs to serve only those who have assets worth less than $15,000, not including a house, a first car, or up to $10,000 of a second car. The legislation also will add a stricter verification process. I think we'll see an increase in the number of people that are looking to food pantries for grocery assistance, Guardado said. We have a very low rate of fraud with the SNAP program in our state, so I think there won't be individuals that won't qualify necessarily, but there's a lot of hoops for families to go through. Many of them may choose not to or may not be able to jump through the hoops that are being created. Can Iowa come back from food scarcity? The importance of community donations and support can't be emphasized enough when it comes to food banks and nonprofits, according to Guardado. But in order to create long-lasting change regarding food availability, Iowa needs to focus on creating statewide policies and programs that serve the needs of all Iowans. You can give money, you can give food, you can give time. You can get involved volunteering at a food bank or a food pantry, but you can also share your voice with the lawmakers, Guardado said. Feed Iowa First, a Linn County-based nonprofit, strives to create the kinds of programs that can support food production in Iowa long-term, according to Emily Renshaw, its executive director. The nonprofit has two main programs. The first, Grow, Don't Mow, is a program that works with businesses, churches, and other organizations to use land that might otherwise be empty lawn space to grow produce. That produce is distributed to the community through the local food pantries and the Feed Iowa First Veggie Van. The second program is the Equitable Land Access Program, through which the nonprofit works with immigrant or other underserved communities to help individuals find available farmland and get established as farmers in Iowa. How do we solve hunger? That's a really complex problem, but a lot of times we just talk about getting food into the food banks, and we really need to start addressing how do we get people on land, and how are we able to grow for all the different communities that are settling here in Cedar Rapids and allow them to grow for themselves, Renshaw said. According to Renshaw, producing enough food to combat hunger in the long term is a matter of creating programs that support food growth, such as the Equitable Land Access Program, or like the recently expanded Cedar Rapids Community Garden Plan, which Renshaw helped create as a member of the steering committee. It's also a matter of creating laws that support farmers and make food production more achievable. We always say in our area, sustainable farming is sustainable for everyone except the farmer. There are high burnout rates, it's long hours, it's low pay. I think we need to look holistically at our food system and what needs to change, Renshaw said. Okay, our next story, Prairie Family was homeless till people helped. College community schools assisted, then social service nonprofits gave a hand up. This is by Grace King. Out of Cedar Rapids. When Ashley Barr and her two children, first and third graders at Prairie Ridge Elementary School, left an unsafe living situation, they had nowhere to go, and Barr wasn't sure who to turn to. Social service agencies found the family a place in a shelter in Waverly, 75 miles away from Cedar Rapids, where Barr's children went to school in the College Community School District. As a mother, I feel like my children were put through a lot they didn't deserve, Barr said. I'm sad that's the route life went, but at the same time, I knew we had to leave. It made me feel liberated. I did something nobody in their wildest dreams thought I was capable of doing. After letting her children's Prairie Ridge teachers know what was going on, Barr was put in touch with Javier Rivera, one of the district's community engagement specialists. Although the school couldn't transport her children from Waverly to Cedar Rapids for school because of a shortage of bus drivers, they were able to reimburse Barr for the travel. That helped immensely, Barr said. It helped put gas in the tank, so I still had money for the kids' necessities. Community specialists. Many school districts now have community engagement specialists to help families when they're having problems with housing, utilities, basic needs, legal or substance abuse problems. They also provide support to immigrant and refugee families as they navigate a new country and language. And they provide support to families facing safety, domestic violence, mental health, physical health, and child care concerns. There's someone in the district who will be your advocate, Rivera said. All families have to do is contact their child's teacher or building principal. Food pantry. Barr also was able to make use of the Prairie Cares Food Assistance Program. The market, located in Prairie High School, is available to all Prairie students and families. Families can place an order to pick up a food box on Thursdays containing dry goods, bread, fresh food, and hygiene products. Barr said it would have been a billion times easier to enroll her children in the Waverly School District than to make the 150-mile round trip to and from Cedar Rapids. But she said it was important to her that her children stay in their classrooms where they had friends and had built positive relationships with their teachers. I would go to war for the College Community School District, said Barr, who now works in the district's Early Childhood Center. The family dog. During all the disruption in their lives, animal control officers took away the family's dog, a 1-year-old Dobson Jack Russell Terrier named Pebbles, because he was behind in his vaccinations, including the one for rabies. The kids and I were absolutely devastated. It destroyed us. Words can't even describe how I felt, said Barr, adding she didn't have the means at the time to take the dog to a veterinarian. The Iowa Humane Alliance, a nonprofit in Cedar Rapids, neutered, vaccinated, and clipped Pebbles' nails at no charge to Barr. Now in a house. After living in the Waverly shelter for 4 months, Barr and her children were able to move back to Cedar Rapids into a 3-bedroom house, a home made possible through Friends of the Family, another nonprofit. Barr said she and her children can live there for a year or two while she gets on her feet. About 30% of her income goes towards rent. They are working with me to build that financial stability, she said. When her children look back on this difficult time, Barr said she hopes they know their mother took a stand for a better life for her and her kids. It wasn't an easy decision to make, Barr said. It was worth a lot of tears and a lot of waiting. She wants other families not to be afraid to reach out to their school if they're facing housing insecurity. All pride aside, there's people willing to help, she said. Helping kids succeed. Rivera said he works with between 50 and 60 families each year in the College Community District who are facing homelessness. That number rose to almost 100 families at the start of the pandemic in 2020, he said. When Rivera learns of a family experiencing homelessness, he makes that family his priority, connecting them with social services and nonprofits in Cedar Rapids to help them bounce back, he said. I recommend families be relentless in seeking help, Rivera said. I want to help be part of solving the problem and making things simple and less stressful for kids, Rivera said. We want every kid at school every day on time. That's the goal. Laura Medberry, Executive Director of Learning Supports at Prairie, and said schools have academic, social, and emotional support services to help students who are experiencing adversity, including homelessness. There's no reason to be ashamed of anything that is a barrier to education, Medberry said. We want to partner with families and keep chipping away at those barriers so kids can be kids, appreciate their school experience, be here every day, and be successful. All right, our next story is many transgender health bills came from a handful of far-right groups. AP analysis finds legislation passed in Iowa, other states, mirrors groups' proposals. And this is out of the Associated Press. Aaron and Lacey Jennings' roots in Arkansas run deep. They've spent their entire lives there, attended the flagship state university, and are raising a family. So they're heartbroken at the prospect of perhaps having to move to one of an ever-dwindling number of states where gender-affirming health care for their transgender teenage daughter, Sabrina, is not threatened. We were like, okay, if we could just get Sabrina to 18, we can put all this horrible stuff behind us, Aaron Jennings said. And unfortunately, that's not been the case, as you've seen a proliferation of anti-trans legislation here in Arkansas and across the country. At least 17 states, including Iowa, have enacted laws restricting or banning gender-affirming care for transgender minors, though judges have temporarily blocked their enforcement in some, including Arkansas. An Associated Press analysis found that often those bills sprang not from grassroots or constituent demand, but from the pens of a handful of conservative interest groups. Many of the proposals, as introduced or passed, are identical or very similar to some model legislation the AP found. Those ready-made bills have been used in state houses for decades, often with criticisms of carpetbagging by out-of-state interests. In the case of restrictions on gender-affirming care for youth, they allow a handful of far-right groups to spread a false narrative based on distorted science, critics say. These are solutions from outside our state looking to solve non-existent problems inside our state, Aaron Jennin said. For whatever reason, they have the ear of legislatures in states like Arkansas, and the legislators will generally defer to and only listen to those individuals. The AP obtained the texts of more than 130 bills in 40 state legislatures from Plural, a public policy software company, and analyzed them for similarities to model bills peddled by the conservative groups Do No Harm, which also criticizes efforts to diversify staffing in medicine, and the Family Research Council, which has long been involved in abortion restrictions. One of the clearest examples is in Montana, where nearly all the language in at least one bill can be found in Do No Harm's model. Publicly available emails from December show the Republican sponsor, Senator John Fuller, tweaked the model before introducing it weeks later. Democrats criticized his efforts. This is not a Montana issue. It is an issue pushed by well-funded national groups, Democratic Senator Janet Ellis said during debate in February. Republicans pushed back. Someone mentioned this is not a Montana solution, and I can tell you that I won my election on this issue, said Republican Senator Barry Usher, who ran unopposed in the general election after winning his contested primary. The Montana bill passed in March with much of Do No Harm's model language intact and has been signed into law. Some see Republican strategy to use social wedge issues. Do No Harm's model and the 2021 Arkansas bill, endorsed as a model by the Family Research Council, also have many similarities, including the assertion, rebutted by major medical organizations, that the risks of gender-affirming care outweigh its benefits. Republicans' recent focus on legislation to restrict aspects of transgender life is largely a strategy of using social wedge issues, in the past, abortion or same-sex marriage, to motivate their voting base, political observers say. And it does appear to resonate. A Pew Research Center survey a year ago found broad support among Republicans, but not Democrats, for restrictions on medical care for gender transitions. These organizations are not introducing this model legislation to make legislators' jobs easier, to support kids in their constituencies. They're introducing this model legislation to gain wealth, to gain eyes, to gain power, and to gain access, said Heron Greensmith, a senior research analyst who monitors anti-LGBTQ rhetoric for Political Research Associates, a liberal think tank. Such bills often distort valid science that supports gender-affirming care for youth, said Dr. Jack Drescher, a psychiatry professor at Columbia University who edited the section about gender dysphoria in the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic Manual. Do No Harm cites the manual in its model bill. These bills are not at all interested in patient care, Drescher said. These bills are designed to inflame. It's problematic anytime policymakers are cherry-picking isolated studies or scientific research that arrives upon a different conclusion than the rest of the community, or that relies upon studies without having that expertise, said Marty Jordan, an assistant professor of political science at Michigan State University. It's problematic for the individuals that the legislation could impact. It's problematic for the larger public, and problematic for democracy writ large, on a mission to protect children from extreme gender ideology. Do No Harm launched last year with an initial focus on the role of race in medical education and hiring, and the Virginia-based nonprofit has registered lobbyists in at least four states. People associated with it have testified in state houses around the U.S. When asked about Do No Harm's legislative activity, founder and chair Dr. Stanley Goldfarb responded in an email, "Do No Harm works to protect children from extreme gender ideology through original research, coalition building, testimonials from parents and patients who've lived through deeply troubling experiences, and advocacy for the rigorous, apolitical study of gender dysphoria. The Family Research Council, an advocacy group that opposes abortion and LGBTQ rights, has been behind what it calls the Save Adolescents from Experimentation Act, or SAFE Act. Among other things, it falsely asserts that gender transition is an experiment. A leader of the Family Research Council declined to answer several questions about its model bill, but said what should be an issue debated in the scientific community now has to be dealt with through legislation. The SAFE Act gives minors a chance to experience development before imposing lifelong chemical and surgical procedures that increasingly show evidence of psychological and physiological harm and completed suicide after the transition. Jennifer Balrens, the organization's director of family studies, said in an email. In Arkansas, Sabrina Jenin, who will turn 18 in July, continues to receive gender-affirming health care while her family's lawsuit winds through the courts. For those outside groups, to carry more weight than the people these legislators were elected to represent is very upsetting, Aaron Jenin said. They didn't listen to us before, but now they have to listen to us because we filed a lawsuit and went to court. Okay, I'm going to turn to the Iowa Today section. And the headline is, Iowa County leads state in violations in home health. County tallied 37 state violations in 6 months. And this is by Clark Kaufman from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. The Iowa County Public Health Department's home health agency has been cited for 37 violations over the past 6 months, far more violations than any other home health provider in the state. As a result of the state inspector's findings, Iowa County Public Health and its registered nurses have been barred from evaluating the skills and competency of the county's home health aides through November of 2024, according to the Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals. Since mid-November 2022, 13 of Iowa's home health agencies have been cited by the state agency for violations, although most of the 13 were cited for three or fewer violations. Five of the 13 agencies that were cited for violations are run by county public health departments. The Iowa County Public Health Department's home health agency was cited for 34 violations in November and three additional violations in December. Many of the violations were related to nursing assessments, medication reviews, incomplete care plans, competency evaluations, personnel qualifications, emergency preparedness, and numerous organizational issues. The organization's 37 violations is roughly 10 times the average number of violations cited by state inspectors at other home health agencies statewide. According to state inspectors, Iowa County's new public health administrator and the Iowa County Board of Health met last July and discussed the need to inform state and federal regulators of a change in management for the home health agency, but then neglected to provide the regulators with that information. A month later, in August of 2022, the county was working with a consultant on a mock audit to help prepare for the anticipated state inspection. The state inspectors later noted that when they attempted to inform the administrator of the violations that were uncovered, the administrator indicated she didn't expect to be surprised since the violations would likely be the same as those noted by the consultant and which had yet to be corrected. The inspectors noted that the county had failed to conduct the required competency testing for aides to ensure they were capable of delivering adequate care, and that the county had initiated services for one patient a week late without notifying the patient's doctor. The inspectors also found the county had failed to conduct the required review of patients' medications in three of the seven cases that were reviewed, had failed to identify duplicate drug regimens for patients, and had failed to have in place accurate, timely care plans for patients that included all of their medications. The county also had failed to update patients' care plans with new physician orders, had failed to give one patient the prescribed skin care treatment on 12 occasions during a 4-week period, and had failed to adequately assess or provide transfer summaries for patients who required hospitalization, according to inspectors. The county also was cited for failing to give its home health patients the name and contact information for either the administrator or the clinical manager so that any concerns pertaining to their care could be properly reported and addressed. The agency's administrator, Lorinda Sheeler, declined to comment on the matter, as did Dr. Steven Rippentrop, chair of the Iowa County Board of Health. They referred all questions about the county's home health operations to the sheriff and to the county attorney, each of whom also declined to comment. Okay, we're going to turn to the opinions in the insight section. We'll read the community letters. Our first letter, regulate guns like SUVs. A recent incident in Texas brings the following to mind. On May 6th, a man in an SUV careened into a crowd of people in Brownsville. He is accused of killing 8 people and injuring 10. For the 10, he faces 10 counts of assault with a deadly weapon, a motor vehicle used as a deadly weapon. Anyone with the money can buy an SUV, but it must have license plates and a title and be registered. The driver must be at least 16, pass a driver's test, and carry a driver's license and insurance. The regulations are accepted public safety measures. They help weed out unqualified people. Though they're regulated, does anyone see any governmental body even thinking about taking our SUVs away? But when people call for firearms control legislation, a common cry arises. They're going to take our guns away. It's an absurd lament. There are more than 13,000 dead this year from gun violence and 300 mass shootings so far this year in the United States. It's high time to regulate firearms, which are notoriously deadly weapons, the same way we regulate other deadly weapons such as motor vehicles. People still die in motor vehicles. Imagine the number of deaths if they were unregulated. Even if guns were regulated, people still would die from them, but the number of deaths by guns would probably plummet with little loss of personal freedom. That letter was from David LaRond of Cedar Rapids. The next letter, Trump Town Hall demonstrates new low for Republicans. Donald Trump and his supporters in attendance exhibited a new low at the New Hampshire Town Hall telecast by CNN. Trump was found liable for sexual abuse and defamation by a New York district judge and jury of his peers, per the requirements of the U.S. Constitution. Trump lied to millions of Americans, stating he didn't know E. Jean Carroll, called her a whack job. The verdict was a disgrace and a continuing witch hunt. The laughs, applause, and cheering by the crowd is a perfect example of where the Republican Party has slumped to. It's not the same party your grandparents and parents supported. It's unable to compromise with the other side of the political aisle for the good of America. It lacks the principles, character, and integrity it once represented, and has replaced those values with conspiracy theories, lies, and extreme agendas. It proudly accepts the support of racists, white supremacists, and authoritarian leaders. Do you support a party that broadcasts its platform through a TV network accused of broadcasting lies, unfounded election claims, and support of Trump? Notice that every Iowa-elected GOP member has remained silent. Would you want your granddaughter, daughter, niece, cousin, or anyone to go through the experience E. Jean Carroll did? Would you stand by your loved one's word or a man proclaiming innocence who refuses to testify in a court of law? Would you trust a judicial system that has worked for hundreds of years? America can do better and must. David Jacobson out of Lansing. Okay. You are listening to Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Karen R. Flannery Alberts, 79, of Cedar Rapids, peacefully passed away at her home surrounded by family on Sunday, May 14th, after a battle with a neurological disease. Her extraordinary journey on this earth came to a close, leaving behind a legacy of compassion, love, and cherished memories. A funeral mass will be offered at 10:30 a.m. Monday, May 22nd, at St. Matthew Catholic Church, with the burial to follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery. All are welcome to join in a light lunch following the burial in Kern Hall at St. Matthew Catholic Church. Terry Luke of Cedar Rapids passed away May 19th after a short illness. Terry was born and lived in Cedar Rapids all his life. He joined the U.S. Navy after school and then worked at Collins Radio as a machinist, retiring in 2001 after 36 years. He loved to fish, hunt, camp, garden, and take cruises and travel in the U.S. with his wife, Orva. He is survived by his wife of 49 years, Orva, sister, Susan Rundy, and sisters-in-law, Mary Luke and Linda Howell, spouse Homer. Two children, Greg and Jackie, three stepsons, James and Lori Lewis of Bellevue, Nebraska, John and Alyssa Lewis, Scott and Tina Lewis. 11 grandchildren, Chrisman, spouse Amanda, Andrea, Martina, Scott Jr., Mason, Zach, Heather, Alyssa, Jamie, Elizabeth, and Bailey. 6 great-grandchildren, Coley, Cade, Kaylee, Nikolai, Ruby, and Luna, and several nieces and nephews. Terry was preceded in death by his parents, John and Genevieve, Jenny, Luke, Crumbaugh, brother, Jack, and sister, Sandra Sturm. A private graveside burial and celebration of life will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be left at Iowa Cremation under obituaries. Patricia Trish Moore of Coralville passed away Friday, May 19th. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 2 p.m. Friday, May 26th at St. Thomas Moore Church in Coralville. Father Chuck Adam will officiate. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. prior to the service. Burial will be at Oak Hill Cemetery in Coralville. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Patricia Moore Memorial Fund in care of P.O. Box 167, Iowa City, Iowa 52244. Trish is survived by her children, Joe, spouse Leanne Moore of Minneapolis, Sean, spouse Audra Moore of Coralville, Joellen, spouse Jeremy Robertson of Clinton, and Coley Marie Duvedi, and sisters-in-law Georgina Finan and Joellen Shoemaker. Trish was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Gary in 2022, infant grandson Riley Moore, and siblings Timothy and John Finan and Elizabeth Finan. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Patricia Moore Memorial Fund in care of P.O. Box 167, Iowa City, Iowa 52244. The complete obituary and online condolences are at lensingfuneral.com. Brandy Evans Pilgrim, 36, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, May 16th, at her home. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, May 25th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Memorial service will begin at 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 26th, at the funeral home, with certified celebrant Amy Hart officiating. Brandy was born on August 5th, 1986, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Jeff and Julie Broderson Evans. She was a graduate of Marion High School. On July 7th, 2016, Brandy was united in marriage to Dan R. Pilgrim at Backbone State Park in Strawberry Point, Iowa. She worked at Cedar Rapids Pain Associates and Woodland Eye Clinic in Dyersville. After the birth of her children, Brandy was a stay-at-home mom to her two precious babies. In her spare time, she enjoyed hiking and boating at their cabin in Guttenberg. Brandy will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Brandy is survived and lovingly remembered by her husband, Dan, children, Raylan and Chase, parents, Jeff and Julie Evans of Cedar Rapids, mother and father-in-law, Dennis and Donna Pilgrim of Manchester, brother-in-law, Jamie, spouse Yuki Pilgrim of Irvine, California, sister-in-law, Jody, spouse Kurt Hatfield of Delhi, and several aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews, and many friends. She was preceded in death by her brother, Michael Evans, in 2015. Grandparents, uncle, Troy Anderson, and brother-in-law at infancy, Nathaniel Pilgrim. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established to benefit her children. Please share a memory of Brandy at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Patricia Pat Ann Klopfenstein, 89, of Marion, passed away on Sunday, May 21st, at Summit Point Memory Care Unit in Marion. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, May 25th, at Marion Methodist Church, 5050 REC Drive, Marion. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, May 26th, at Marion Methodist Church, officiated by the Reverend Mike Morgan. Pat was born on April 1st, 1934, in rural Washington County near Kyoto, the daughter of Jake and Alma Korpman Suthout. She was a 1952 graduate of West Chester High School and went on to attend Iowa State Teachers College, now known as the University of Northern Iowa, in Cedar Falls, where she graduated with her teacher's certificate. On December 6, 1953, Pat was united in marriage to Victor Klopfenstein in Washington, Iowa, and together they had 5 children. Pat was a community pillar and very active in service to her community. She was named the 2011 Marion Citizen of the Year by the Marion Chamber of Commerce and served as a Marion historian. Her many volunteer activities included work for the Marion Preservation Commission, the Marion Library Foundation, the Marion Chamber of Commerce, the Linn County Task Force, the Heritage Agency of Aging, the Marion Food Pantry, and the Marion Methodist Church. She was a member of the OOP Club and the Cedar Rapids Iowa City Friendship Force Club. Pat and Vic hosted over 200 foreign visitors at their home and enjoyed sharing interesting places in the community. Pat was honored by the National Friendship Force Club with the Wayne Smith Medal. The Klopfenstein Amphitheater at Low Park was named in honor of Pat and Vic. In the early 1960s, she was an entrepreneur, spending much time perfecting her baking and becoming known as the cake cook, where at her peak she averaged 44 cakes per week. Early on, she was a teacher, having taught in Mitchellville, Keota, and Ballard Community Schools. Pat served as a court-appointed special advocate for mental health and served many people in a wide area for over 20 years. Pat will be remembered for her pride and joy in raising her 5 children and hosting visits with her extended family. Pat and Vic were longtime members of the Marion Methodist Church. She enjoyed traveling, genealogy, history, sewing, and gardening. She will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Pat is survived and lovingly remembered by her husband of 69 years, Vic, children, Kevin, spouse Deb Klopfenstein of Parker, Arizona, Vivian, spouse Pat Quinn of Marion, Mark Klopfenstein of Marion, Vaughn, spouse Shelley Walker Klopfenstein of Cedar Rapids, and Michelle, spouse Scott Sloan of Altoona, grandchildren, Adrian, spouse Tyler Kuhn, Adam, spouse Nicole Klopfenstein, Brady, spouse Natalie Quinn, Clancy, spouse Tareen Quinn, Riley, spouse Kelsey Quinn, Daly Quinn, Jacqueline, spouse Jeremy Allen, Jake, spouse Megan Klopfenstein, Kayla, spouse Jake Gunther, Peter Klopfenstein, Ian Klopfenstein, Ava Klopfenstein, Ben, spouse Callie Sloan, and Isaac Sloan, 16 great-grandchildren, brother Harold Suthout of Urbandale, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, brother James, spouse Marge Suthout, and sister-in-law Norma Suthout. Memorials in Pat's memory may be directed to the Marion Heritage Center at P.O. Box 753, Marion, 52302, or the Marion Methodist Church at 5050 REC Drive, Marion, Iowa, 52302. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family. Please share a memory of Pat at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. The family would like to thank the staff at Summit Point and St. Croix Hospice for the excellent care they provided Pat. Donald L. Rivers, 80, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, May 18th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 24th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Funeral service will begin at 11 a.m. Thursday, May 25th at Faith Lutheran Church, located 155 Boyson Road in Marion, and the Reverend John Albertson officiating. Burial will follow at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. Donald was born on February 10, 1943 in Sioux City, the son of Thomas and Helen Brenner Rivers. He graduated from Central High School in Sioux City and went to attend Drake University for education before earning his master's degree in history from the University of Iowa. Donald was a lifelong learner. He used his love of knowledge to publish and edit college textbooks for over 8 different subject areas for Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, Rand McNally, and William C. Brown companies. Donald served as National Account Sales Manager for Better Homes and Gardens Books, Division of Meredith Corporation, for over 9 years. He spent 2 years building a new division for Hahn Industries, XLM, building it into a $10 million division. After retirement, Donald worked with startup companies and independent retailers, served on various church leadership boards, and was the board president of the Cops Against Cancer organization. He was an avid reader, loved puzzles, fishing, running marathons, and his cats. Donald liked to be part of family gatherings and was very committed to his church. He had a very giving spirit and was always willing to help anyone at any time. Donald will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved him. Donald is survived and lovingly remembered by his daughter, Tiffany, spouse Steve Beavers of Cedar Rapids, grandsons Thomas and Nick Beavers of Cedar Rapids, sister Mary Irene Stanton of Mason City, nieces and nephews Lindy, spouse Dave Worden of Minnesota, Suzanne Stanton of Ankeny, Patrick, spouse Brenda Stanton of Michigan, Cindy, spouse Dan Langanke of Minnesota, and Sarah, spouse Ron Cray of South Carolina, and Aunt Roseanne Tice of Sioux City. He was preceded in death by his parents, brother Thomas Rivers, and brother-in-law Harry Stanton. Please share a memory of Donald at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Joseph Sari of Cedar Rapids, that's S-A-A-R-I, 51, died Thursday, May 18th. Friends may visit with the family from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 23rd, at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of Life services will be held 1 p.m. Wednesday, May 24th, at the chapel. Dwayne Paul Meineke, 72, of Olin, passed away Friday, May 19th. Per his request, Dwayne has been cremated and will be interred at Green Center Cemetery in Morley. Survivors include his children, Brandy Iverson, Nicholas Meineke, and Sarah Bracht Wagner, a niece, Julia McQuaid, and nephews, Robert L. Meineke and Richard J. R.J. Meineke. Dwayne was preceded in death by his parents, brother Frederick Fritz Meineke, and sister Nancy McQuaid. Dwayne was born on January 25, 1951, in Anamosa, to Paul and Margaret Meineke. He graduated from Olin High School. Dwayne served in the U.S. Navy from 1970 to 1974 on board USS Concord. Dwayne was a loyal Iowa Hawkeyes fan, and his favorite hobby was woodworking. Memorials may be directed to the charity of your choice in Dwayne's name. A graveside service will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be left for the family at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Pam Ward, 60, of Newton, passed away Friday, May 19th at Newton Healthcare Center. Services will be held 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 24th at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. Visitation beginning at 10 a.m. with family present. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website under the obituary for Pamela Ward. Under the video tab, starting at 11 a.m., Wednesday, May 24th. Burial will be at Dunkard Cemetery. Survivors include her sister, Deb Wagner of Newton, nieces, Lori Foreman of Grinnell, Wendy, spouse Chad Van Sant of Kirksville, Missouri, and Vicky, spouse John Moore, foreman of Montezuma, along with many great-nieces, great-nephews, and great-great-nieces. Pam was preceded in death by her parents, grandparents, and niece, Kelly Jo. Pam Ward was born on April 23, 1963, to Robert and Helen Ward in Cedar Rapids. Pam was a loving and delightful child to all who knew her. Pam enjoyed dancing and listening to music. She was known for her infectious laugh and smile and was loved by all who knew her. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to the Down Syndrome Foundation. Online condolences may be left for the family at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Wayne Norman Schilling, 87, of Marion, passed away peacefully at Mercy Hallmar on Friday, May 19th. Wayne was born November 22, 1935, in Jefferson, the son of John and Helen Schilling. He enjoyed his childhood on the family farm, but new farming wasn't for him, so upon graduation, Wayne enlisted in the U.S. Navy and served on the USS Brinkley Bass Destroyer from 1954 to 1957. Wayne met the love of his life, Darlene Leslie, on a blind date, and on August 16, 1959, the couple were married at Zion Lutheran Church in Auburn. Des Moines was home for the couple before Wayne accepted a maintenance position at Lindell Plaza in 1967. His career at Lindell would span 33 years and include seeing the mall become enclosed, helping with countless mall attractions, and utilizing his Navy training to maintain the boiler and chiller units. Wayne and his bike were a fixture on Collins Road as he biked to and from work most every day. At Lindale, Wayne was given the nickname the Silver Fox by mall merchants, a tribute to his gray hair and slender physique. He took great pride in maintaining his Navy weight throughout much of his life. Faith was introduced to Wayne through Darlene, and Bethany Lutheran Church was his home since the 60s. Wayne served as a deacon, usher, and counter at Bethany and recently enjoyed the monthly senior worships with Pastor Erickson and Nurse Rhonda Anderson. Wayne's retirement was cut short due to a massive stroke 10 years ago, which changed his life forever. Wayne's will, determination, good spirits allowed him the best possible life post-stroke. Amazing caregivers flowed throughout the house and allowed both Wayne and Darlene to remain at home longer than most. Wayne is survived by his three children, David, spouse Carol Schilling of Tennessee, Keith, spouse Tracy Schilling of Shuiville, and Linda, spouse Joe Skvor of Cedar Rapids. Grandchildren, Michael, spouse Jess Stuchnitsky Schilling of Florida, Anna, spouse Derek Holman of Tennessee, Carly, fiancé Ben Turnley Schilling of Oklahoma, Caden Schilling of Shuiville, Jake Skvor of Marion, Samuel, spouse Allison Skvor of New Jersey, and Shane Skvor of Cherokee. His four cats will miss him, but no doubt Wayne will miss them even more. Wayne was preceded in death by his parents, his wife of 61 years, Darlene, his brothers Robert and Donald, sister Mary Jeannie Tedrow, and grandson Josh Skvor. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, May 25th at Bethany Lutheran Church, 2202 Forest Drive, Southeast Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at Bethany at 11 a.m. Friday, May 26th, with a luncheon to follow. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to Bethany Lutheran Church or your favorite charity in memory of the best dad ever. June Ann Brown Swallum, 91, of Guttenberg, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away at home surrounded by her family on May 19th following a short illness. Private services will be held. Interment will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. June was born on July 6, 1931, to Roy Edward and Charlotte Hannah Wilkins Brown in Luana. She married Charles A. Chuck Swallum, July 15, 1949, who her two sons, Charles Michael, Mike, of Guttenberg, and Roy Edward, spouse Nancy, of Williston, North Dakota, were important to her and made her so proud. She enjoyed her adult roller skating group and bowling teams. She is survived by her husband of almost 74 years, two sons and a daughter-in-law, two grandchildren, Daniel, spouse Tiffany Swallum, and Virginia A. Swallum, three great-grandsons, Miles, Blaine, and Thomas Swallum, sister Rose Perkins, sister-in-law Vivian Sis Wenger, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, sister Betty Dankert, brothers-in-law Kenneth Dankert, Jack Perkins, Jim Wenger, and Leonard, spouse Barbara Swallum, stepfather Louis Wagner, and stepsisters Doris Murphy, Donifred Hinman, Darlene Russett, and Dorothy Hines. June's family would like to extend a special thank you to the staff of St. Croix Hospice for their caring support in her during her final days. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed towards the charity of your choice. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. R. Gordon Wagner, 84, of Watkins, entered his heavenly home on May 20th. Gordon passed peacefully at his home, surrounded by family, after complications from heart failure. Gordon was born July 1, 1938, to Ralph and Grace Gorvin Wagner, south of Oxford. Gordon was one of nine siblings growing up on the farm and attended country school until attending and graduating from Oxford High School in 1956. Gordon met his wife, Leola Becker, and they were married February 26, 1962. Gordon and Leola moved to the Becker farm in Watkins in 1964 and had six children, 15 grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, Ralph and Grace, in-laws Leo and Opal Becker, son Joseph, granddaughter Sarah Wagner, siblings Dick Wagner, Elaine Mead, and Bob Wagner, and his in-laws Dion, Lauren, Vernon, Donna, and Jack. Gordon is survived by his wife of 61 years, Leola, daughters Corinne, spouse Joe, Kim, Andrea, spouse Chad Klosterman, and Jessica, spouse Neil Ryan, and sons Don, spouse Judy, and Ron, spouse Tammy. Gordon enlisted in the Iowa National Guard in 1961 and served 6 years. Gordon farmed his whole life and had a special love for raising beef cattle. Gordon enjoyed fishing and camping, as well as deer and pheasant hunting, with his family and friends on their property. Gordon and Leola loved traveling and fishing. Canada was his favorite annual trip with his wife, children, and their families. The family would like to extend a special thanks to Gordon's granddaughter, Danielle Kim Schulte, for her loving care that allowed him to remain at home in peace and comfort during his final months, along with his loving wife, Leola. Thank you to the cardiology team at St. Luke's Hospital and the nurses at Hospice of Mercy. Gordon's life will be celebrated with a visitation from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday, May 22nd, at St. Michael's Catholic Church of Norway, with a prayer service at 5 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 23rd, at the church, with Father Craig Stimel officiating. Burial will take place at St. Patrick's and St. Paul's Cemetery in Watkins, with military honors. Memorials may be made to the family. Online condolences can be sent to hrabakfuneralservice.com. Brosh Funeral Service of Norway is assisting the family. Bonnie Lucille Quass of Council Bluffs died May 19th. Bonnie will rest in peace next to Howard at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Friday, May 26th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, with a short graveside ceremony afterward. Bonnie was born in Springville, Iowa, on January 8, 1929, to Ruth Pollock and Clarence A. McGrew. She grew up on the family farm west of Springville and graduated from Springville High School in 1947. She worked at the Linn County REC for several years. Bonnie married Howard George Quass on September 10, 1950. They had four children and raised them on their farm just east of Robbins, where Westfield Elementary School and Pinecrest Drive are now located. She enjoyed quilting, gardening, and square dancing. She was preceded in death by her parents, Ruth and Clarence A. McGrew, her husband, Howard G. Quass, her eldest son, Daniel H. Quass, and her two brothers, William J. McGrew and David McGrew. She is survived by three children, Carol J. Quass of Council Bluffs, Stuart W. Quass, spouse Cynthia J. Gay of Council Bluffs, and Thomas A. Quass, spouse Debbie Briggs of Bellevue, Nebraska, as well as grandchildren, Brandy Quass, spouse Daniel Hamilton of Lakeland, Florida, and Amanda Nemhard Dietrich of Atlanta, Georgia, Matthew Quass and Lindsay Mesher Nolan, spouse Nolan of Council Bluffs, and Michael Quass, spouse Michaela Watson of Bellevue, Nebraska, and Catherine Quass of Lee's Summit, Missouri, and great-grandchildren Kyla Kirby and Caden Hamilton of Lakeland, Florida, and Malcolm Nemhard of Atlanta, Georgia. Memorial donations may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be left for the family at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Doris E. Lynch, 95, of West Branch, passed away Friday, May 19th, at the Crestview Specialty Care, surrounded by her family. Doris Evelyn Dewey was born on May 4, 1928, to Albert and Carrie Fout Dewey in Graham Township, Johnson County, Iowa. Doris attended rural schools in Johnson County and later attended Commercial College in Iowa City. On February 5, 1948, she married Hubert F. Lynch and moved to the Lynch family farm she and Hubert owned in Cedar County. Doris and Hubert farmed their entire married life, raising traditional farm animals and crops. After transitioning from traditional farming, they raised guinea pigs for research and pets. At the height of their business, which afforded them many adventures and new friends, they managed over 2,000 animals. After the death of her husband, Hubert Lynch, in 2003, Doris moved to a house built by her sons in West Branch, where she was active in quilting, cards, and volunteering at Crestview. On weekends, she returned to the farm to spend time at a small cabin on a pond built by her son, Larry. Anyone who knew Doris knew her love and knowledge of animals, especially frogs. Doris is survived by four sons and two daughters, Marcia Howe, Dale, spouse Connie Lynch, Sharon, spouse Curtis Voperil, Wayne, spouse Deb Lynch, Steve, spouse Cindy Lynch, and Larry, spouse Amy Lynch, all of West Branch, 11 grandchildren and 15, soon to be 16, great-grandchildren. Doris was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, Hubert Lynch, her brothers, Lawrence and Charles, and five sisters, Alice, Mary, Nellie, Annie, and Gladys. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 23rd at the Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 24th at St. Bernadette Catholic Church. I think that should be May 24th. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 24th at St. Bernadette Catholic Church in West Branch. Burial will be in the St. Joseph Cemetery, Cedar Valley. Online condolences may be made to the family at hendersonbarkerfuneralhome.com. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Doris Lynch Memorial Fund. And that's about all we have time for today. It brings us to the end of our reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.